You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is almost the 6th of July, 2025, and I am not feeling well. I am definitely off physically, but it's just, I don't get sick very often, so when I get sick, I have no idea what to do. But this is why we get married. I was surprised that Mikhail Magnitsky was going to take more than one episode, but the more I understand the situation, the more it makes sense. His role is very much underestimated. And when he is estimated, it's usually done very poorly. And there's some reasons for that, though. We've already spoken about. The last thing we said, this is part two of Mikhail Magnitsky against the Masons, against the revolution. And I think the last thing we said is something that I've been saying for many years. Talking about he refers to the Illuminati. Again, this is in the 1820s. He means this in a very broad sense. He's not talking about a specific organization. He's talking about any of the revolutionary cells operating in secret. But I quoted him. I'll say it again. These words, under the guise of expressions known to everybody, having a mutual meaning, constitute a kind of universal language which the Illuminati use in order to speak safely among themselves from one end of the world to the other, so that the European peoples, having listened to it, inadvertently memorize and repeat their dogmas, thus forming mechanically, so to speak, a common opinion, their meaning. I can't stress how important that is in terms of the manipulation of public opinion. This was the alteration of the default settings of European peoples, you know, certainly not just Russia. And in fact, the attempt to do it in Russia failed miserably. Magnitsky had a plan. He wanted to create the Institute of Oriental Languages in Astrakhan. He wanted to deal with the ancient tradition. He wanted, well, you remember, he was at University of Kazan, in contact with, many of the scholars of India and bringing them over, information on the teachings of the Brahmins, and seeing the connections between the two. This isn't some obscurantist. This is certainly no obscurantist. However, rooting out corruption at the University of Kazan or any place like that, there's a sense in which it has to be done, at least at first, mechanically. It shouldn't be. But it's hard to do it otherwise. And it's easy to lampoon that. One of the things he did, he saw how university life just made degenerates out of students. Now, we know that today as a matter of course. He wanted to create a spiritual institution. He didn't like the idea of a secular educational institution because it's always going to collapse into debauchery. You see, it wasn't just a matter of grades. There was a comprehensive moral category which included, in fact, moral content. So, excellent, very good, good students. The second, you know, mediocre, maybe correctable. And, well, there was a third, under special supervision. And students assigned to these categories were placed and lodged on different floors, only met together for lectures. But even here, there was some attempt to make sure there was no communication among them. He realized that education is not just a matter of rote learning, memorization. Of course, that has a very important role. You got to remember, St. Petersburg at the time, they were speaking French, they were speaking German, anything but Russian. And this is the nation that just a short time ago pushed the French out of Russia all the way back to Paris. Had the opportunity to remake European politics within the Holy Alliance. You know what university life is like. I know. I enjoyed it very much when I was a young man. 4 years at the University of Hartford. But, and it was almost impossible to avoid this in the normal run of things. But Magnitsky realized, well, this is still a healthy society. The lodges hadn't penetrated. You know, we've talked about the destruction of the 18th century. How there was a tremendous you know, the sexual revolution and nonsense that came from Byron and those very, very corrupt years after the death of, well, within Peter's reign, of course, but, you know, Peter had a whole drunken synod, satanic thing going on. But this was to give a comprehensive understanding of a student. This is, education is comprehensive. Education is not just what you have in school. So, the point of a university, almost like going into the army, you take a student from the home life and you remake them. The only thing you don't have is, you know, that boot camp experience. He wanted to avoid that. He wanted to avoid the debauchery that seems to come with university life. I probably wouldn't have liked it as an 18-year-old. I would have ideologically agreed with it. I would understand it, but maybe I wouldn't have liked it so much. And you had supervisors at the dorms, inspecting everything. Outsiders can visit, you know, on normal days, holidays, whenever, for certain groups of students under the direct supervision of the supervisor. Now, of course, as far as control is concerned, that's nothing compared to the university of today. Young student goes to the university, and within 2-3 months, maybe, he is turned into a completely different person. No different than going into the army, as I've said. Now, the control of the American university today, 2025, it's a totalitarian system there. And you better agree to it. You know, I couldn't go back to the university if my life depended on it, which hurts me some days because I was very good at it. But they have perverted education. Unfortunately, Magnitsky, this stuff didn't, the revolutionary movements, at least for a time, won. Keep in mind, too, the reason that we're talking about him is how early he saw the secret societies and the revolutionary movements functioning all over the world. He wasn't talking about this in the 1860s. He was talking about the 1820s. And he saw how they were using college students, molding them. It's not just about education being a matter of the mind, but they manipulated the body. They used alcohol. They used, you know, the typical Jewish tricks. Unfortunately, there were some who weren't capable of debauchery, not by choice, but And of course, that was nothing compared to the Soviet version. So people, you know, like to condemn him for this kind of thing, and it was never quite implemented. But there are no vacuums. There are no vacuums in politics or anything else. One ideology or the other is going to take over. There's no free thinking. On the other hand, an atmosphere like this, he did impose this for a time. Gave rise to students informing on each other. They do that today, of course. There were a list of punishments for violation of the rules. And it's not just in the classroom, but elsewhere. A bread and water imprisonment or a fast. These were called, you know, the sinners. Prayers were said for them. And unfortunately, for those who were just incorrigible, they were sent into the army if they simply couldn't be dealt with. Actually, there were only two students in his entire time. Well, he wasn't there long, but he was essentially an auditor. Two students were sent to the army for the immoderate consumption of alcohol. Because, you know, that never leads to problems. I mean, I have to admit, it's a miracle I made it. I was a straight-A student. And I was nothing. I could have been arrested so many times. You know, it's a miracle I made it through. Now, interestingly, it wasn't just the students at the University of Kazan that were subject to supervision. Professors were too. Now, of course, they desperately need this and hate it, of course. In fact, they hate anything that gives any kind of, that forced them to be responsible. If you remember when RateMyProfessors.com came out in 2005, whatever it was, there were all of these, you know, petitions from university professors to shut it down. That's very interesting. It's still up. People are still leaving reviews. They hate this concept. Remember, this isn't, you know, you had the French Revolution, you had Napoleon's invasion, this is just a short time later. You had a lot of people killed. The worry of revolution was extreme. People who were promoting it were irresponsible. But here, lectures and syllabi had to be submitted ahead of time. Now, I would have hated that, but not for the reasons that your typical university professor would have hated it. There weren't elected positions there anymore. The left was just getting the Jewish left was just getting a foothold in the universities, and they despise any concept of oversight or exposure. There were some, as I mentioned, I think last week, personnel changes to the university. And the faculty are not, tenure is such a fraud. Although tenure doesn't really exist anymore. It's very easy to get around. I've seen it happen myself. Of course, once the left took over, again, because there's no vacuum in education or politics or anything else, they then enforced their rule very much like this. Far worse than anything that Magnitsky had planned. There was a certain sense of either hypocrisy or servility, although today's virtue signaling is identical to that. Well, that's beholden to a very different and less healthy agenda. The ideological molding wasn't nearly as intense and violent as it is today. But Kazan University, remember, he was sent there from the Tsar himself. This was created by the monarchy. They had every right to do what they pleased with it. Remember, in the first quarter of the 19th century, Russian science was still just getting started. only in a later period began to challenge the West in a lot of different ways. Yes, he hindered the development of things like, you know, rationalism, nominalism. But as far as the natural sciences go, mathematics and history, that wasn't altered at all, because they don't imply one another. Now, I said last week that he had a strange conception. The translation is natural law. There's no other way to translate it. But what he means by natural law is naturalism, that everything can be explained through biological mechanisms. And he said this about it. The science of natural law, without which ancient Rome managed, being a kingdom, republic, and empire, and leaving us not only examples of the most perfect legal advisors, but also the most perfect civil legislation, without which France managed for 800 years, without which all the universities of England and Italy managed to this day, are famous for their excellent lawyers. The science of natural law, this metaphysics of rights, an adjunct to popular, public, and positive law, is an invention of the unbelief of the later times in northern Germany. And of course, he's correct. That's not how I use natural law. That's not how most of us use natural law. But he means naturalism. So I shouldn't even say it, but that's how he writes it. Another way of putting it is the substitution of theoretical, or things like theoretical physics, in the place of practical or empirical physics. Those promoting progress, there's always a weird thing in Marxism, that if these things are inevitable, you know, why do you need to write about it? If these things are, if the workers are going to take over, and that's inevitable, well, part of the inevitability is Marx writing about it, I guess. That's very much a part of this determined fate. But saying that progress, we see it today with everything. You can't turn back the clock. That's inevitable. It's impossible to stop. That's very convenient. It cloaks its promoters as passive subjects of fate. Nothing democratic about this, by the way. The economy is entirely the creation of the elites. No one votes what's going to be the fashion from season to season. Were they any less happy in ancient Rome than industrial England? I say in industrial England they were much less happy. And precisely as Magnitsky was writing, the Darwinist ideology was being formulated in Britain, which was a very convenient tool, which initially was an economic one, a cloak behind which the powerful might hide to destroy their enemies. Something that was inconceivable morally a century ago, two centuries ago. Now it's just, well, a part of nature, and it's inevitable. Darwin admitted that his ideas were economic, came from Malthus. But what was initially a purely economic argument was imposed on the natural world. One that certainly gave great comfort to the colonialists and the new captains of industry as they destroyed their competition. Under natural selection, there were no limits on the power that they could wield. Both the capitalists and the later Marxists would use Darwin to buttress their dubious claims of progress, even if by force. I know I spent quite a bit of time studying what natural selection is. This isn't something new to me. And initially, it's not really, it wasn't, at least at first, a biological concept. It was an economic concept. Again, I don't want anyone to think that he was a, someone who opposed legitimate development. Progress and development are two very different things. Everything develops. Kids grow up, and that's not what we're talking about. He loved the idea. He hated rationalism. He hated nominalism. I mentioned the Ostracon thing, both the West and the East. He had all kinds of expeditions. He sent scientists to Germany, France, and England to study mathematics, to find manuscripts of the ancient world. In fact, he even made a plan to go to the Armenian monasteries, because some ancient and unknown texts were there. people had heard about them, but weren't sure that they existed, but they did. He created a university. I don't want to say it's a monastic institution. That's not true. This is a very different society. This was a, even the architecture at the time reflected what he was trying to do. In no way could the modern academic ever defend his world of academia compared to Magnitsky. He was a libertarian compared to how they run things today. We talked last week about Alexander Golitsyn. We talked about the Bible Society and this war that developed in the Russian mind during the reign of Alexander I, where the Freemasons, the promoters of the very early promoters of revolution and what we would call ecumenism, came in under the cloak of, they were Protestants, they came in under the cloak of translating the Bible. Well, of course, they had their own Bible. They had it for many years. So they didn't mean that. I mean, after all, this is a system that would promote people like Sergei Afraki, who was murdered by the Reds in 1917, Porfiry Bakhmetyev, Tikhon Chicherin, Napoleon Sybulski, Nikita Kokuev, just among the biologists. You had Peter Bagatron, Ivan Borgman in physics and engineering. You had Pavel Schilling and Nikolai Slavinov, Alexander Zasladko. All came from this system in one form or another. Either they were taught there or were taught there. He had every reason to fear. He had every reason to worry about what education could be. If you've been following our now 51 episodes of 200 Years Together, you see that one of the first things, once Poland was partitioned, Eastern Poland became a part of the Russian Empire, which was a disaster because it contained a huge number of Khazars. One of the first things they did was to penetrate the universities. They saw the universities as a laboratory for revolution, not for education. There is no such thing. People, no one believes in free thought, abstractly. They all have an agenda. They believe in truth or falsehood. There are no vacuums. One ideological system or another is going to take over. And Magnitsky laid this out. In fact, his final views on the principles of education and upbringing was in his note on public education, which he presented to Alexander the First on November 7th, 1823. A very comprehensive approach to the university. He talked about the malicious effects of Talleyrand, Napoleon, Adam Weishaupt, how they deliberately distorted the system of public education. It's not a matter of perception, it's not a matter of opinion, but a fact. They helped create revolutionary France. And Magnitsky, being the former ambassador, post-revolutionary ambassador to France, he saw firsthand. Remember, Magnitsky was a Mason. He eventually left it, and then just, you know, railed against it from there on in. When he was a young man with Speransky, well, the liberal Speransky, one of the fathers of Russian liberalism and Masonry. And it didn't take him long to reject it. And from a former Mason, he knows exactly what their plan was. And what was Weishaupt going to do? He had the Masonic Lodge, Theodor zum Guten Rath, in Munich. I think he was in 1777. His project was one of illumination, enlightening the understanding by the Sun of Reason, which will dispel the clouds of superstition and of prejudice. For we know exactly what he meant by those words. A young student might not know. I mean, who's in favor of superstition? And who's in favor of prejudice? It means prejudging something, judging something before you come to know it. It's irrational. That is not what they meant. They were at war with Christ and the monarchy. And Weishaupt was smart enough to use Freemasonry to recruit his own, I guess, semi-Masonic society with the goal of perfecting human nature through re-education to achieve a communal state of nature freed from any organized religion. This is what he thought was pure Freemasonry. And I think the more extreme Masons elsewhere in Europe came from this attempt, organizing their ritual structure. And contrary to what Immanuel Kant said, the Enlightenment, and certainly Weishaupt's order was in some respects an expression of the Enlightenment. It was an expression of the Enlightenment, although, you know, a specific one. It was a passage by a man out of his self-imposed immaturity through daring to make use of his own reason without the guidance of another. Well, he means that as a, you know, once you're finished your education. Of course, no liberal would say that today. Weishaupt's Order of Illuminati prescribed in great detail everything that the members had to think and believe. Free thinking, rational, that was for public relations only. There is nothing more, and I was getting my master's degree. My master's advisor in St. Louis was an anarchist, and of course, you know, it's nonsense. He ran that department with an iron fist. He smashed everything he didn't like. I can't count the number of times I said, well, so much for anarchism then. It's a symbolic revolt. But being a former part of the Masonic Order, he knew the role of these guys very well. A decade later, and I have a couple of quotes here. A decade later, he wrote to Tsar Nicholas I. From 1787, all of these united conspiracies assumed the political aspect under which they were soon to overthrow the altars of the throne of France. In the lodges, they began to say the dawn of the glorious day was appearing, in which the secret of Freemasonry, hitherto inaccessible, would become the property of every free man. In the higher degrees, they began to demand hatred of all religions, and of all kings in general. In the lower Masons, they began to accept the rabble of the Parisian suburbs. Lodges were even established in the villages, in which the peasants were preached the rights of man, equality, freedom. The Duke of Orleans began to accept soldiers of the guard into his lodge, to the point where the aristocrats started to leave. They were spreading all over the place. I'm sorry, that's not in the quote, but clubs were established whose political conclusions were submitted to the Grand Orient for consideration and sent to the provinces. The Duke of Orleans, Mirabeau, Saint-Valé, Condorcet managed the conspiracy. No later than 1788, in the instructions of the great Parisian Orient, masters of the provincial lodges were already threatened with aqua tofana and a dagger if their orders were not followed. Now, I have to admit, I had to look up what aqua tofana was. But the nonsense about free thought, that's only when in your first or second degree. Even ecumenism, that's your second, third, fourth, you know, second, third degree. Before most men, Magnitsky saw the revolution coming. What is aqua tofana? This is what the Parisian Grand Orient threatened their sister lodges with. It's a highly potent, almost undetectable poison created in 17th century North Italy, allegedly by women. to help other women escape what they claim were abusive marriages and poisoning their husbands. It became a symbol of revolution, became a symbol of rebellion for that reason. And of course, the dagger being symbolic, you saw it actually in some of the mafia initiations too. So much for free thought, so much for anarchism, so much for... No, there is nothing more tyrannical than a liberal when he takes over. Now, Magnitsky had Freemasonry in mind first and foremost, but he didn't speak of it directly right away. He spoke of things like, you know, the Prince of the Darkness of this age. Later on in his career, he wrote in the Lodge very extensively. Now, as far as the revolutionaries, he was trying to keep at bay. Here's what he said. I'm going to say I'm going to quote this at length. This is my translation here, because it's very programmatic. It's very important. Magnitsky says in his letters to Nicholas, "The dishonest man says, 'I will be my own king,' and therefore he believes in himself alone, hopes in himself alone, loves himself alone, and attributes everything to himself alone. How does he in this situation differ from the savage? What does this mean other than the destruction of society, which consists in faith and fundamental truths, according to the general testimony of them, and love for others and self-denial flowing from this very same love? Society means a connection with which self-sacrifice is the only beginning of order and the only means for its preservation. Of the two teachings, the fundamental principles which we have here really briefly set forth, one is Christianity, and the other is a heterogeneous collection of private opinions, which is called rationalism. The stormy stream of self-thinking, which by more or less steep slopes, falls into the abyss of atheism very quickly. Now we will show how every opinion passes from the head to the heart and gives birth to a feeling in accordance with itself. Let us take as an example the fundamental law of societies: honor your father and your mother. As soon as that's accepted, from it flow respect for parents, but not just for parents, for superiors, for God himself, and the rule. One is not obliged to anyone except oneself. On the contrary, there is born only exclusive love for yourself, unbridled vanity and pride for those who reject it. The voluntary sacrifice of every man of himself to society is found in the Christian religion. The sacrifice consists in the whole man, the sacrifice of his own opinions and personal way of thinking, the sacrifice of his inclinations and private interests, the sacrifice of his very life in those cases where the general benefit might require it. This is the one solid foundation of society, and therefore it cannot again unshakably be restored in Europe otherwise than by means of religion. That is why the general striving towards it of all people who are still attached to the rules of virtue, the welfare of society by noble feelings, are now so obvious." Now, I know that was long, but we've heard some of this stuff before. Honoring our father and mother is the center core idea of any functional society. And not just because the family is a basic unit. All the things being equal, superiors, to the extent that they are orthodox and adhere to that, are no different than your parents in that respect. Your parents, you know, didn't come from nothing. This was a central focus for his work here. Once that's destroyed, though, as I've said before, that genie is very hard to get back into the box again. There are no king but Jesus idiots. They weren't united on what interpretation of Christ's mission and teachings were. They didn't have any authority to come to any conclusions anyway. I quoted this at length. It's so central to his understanding of Masonry and Illuminism and how it really operated. No system can operate on free opinion. There are no vacuums. One authority or another will decide for you. For him, true natural law was in humility, self-sacrifice, without which no society could function for very long. Otherwise, an oligarchy, the sophists would rule, making the ideas of the wealthiest the most obvious and inevitable. The conspiracy led to the fact that even those teachers who were supposed to teach the heir to the throne were infected. Those dangerous principles of revolution, unbelief, outrageous ideas, and if left unchecked, would lead to yet again another French Revolution. It actually occurred, almost occurred, in the December's Revolt at the death, quote-unquote, of Alexander I in 1825. Those who tried to take over there, they didn't care whether Constantine lived or died. They all came from the lodges. Everything Magnitsky said was true. They all came from the lodges. They all were oligarchs. The most wealthy factions of the society. The Northern Society in particular would create a constitutional monarchy with themselves in charge. And of course, whenever anything went wrong, they blamed the crown for it. He suggested that Alexander I used the tactics and instructions of the enemies of the monarchy. Quote, from them one can, it seems, draw an antidote, as is done in medicine. When a bite from a mad dog is cured with the blood of a mad dog. In other words, to draw up a plan of public education on certain principles that would cover all educational institutions of the Russian Empire. It took the right wing a very long time to learn how to organize like the left. A very long time. In Russia, everything was left to the state. Today, of course, the results of all of this can be seen. But it took an extraordinary mind to see them in the 1820s. The Decembrists were one of the first manifestations of this. Then the revolutionary terror squads shortly thereafter. From Land and Liberty to the Jewish self-defense squads of the early 20th century. Of course, the establishment of the USSR would be the final cap to the pyramid of this evil that this man was able to see coming almost a century before it occurred. The phrase, orthodoxy, autocracy, nationality, that was, it only is credited to Sergei Uvarov. It actually comes from Magnitsky. He wrote on it to some extent, as well, specifically orthodoxy and autocracy. I think the nation was implied. These are the two sacred pillars on which the empire stands, the main principles of public education. Again, one ideology or another is going to dominate. There is no middle ground. No vacuum in politics. Without the first, orthodoxy, the second, autocracy, is impossible. In fact, he said, autocracy outside of orthodoxy is pure violence. It would just be tyranny in that case. The canons limit the crown. Of course, the real concern is who limits the rich. These two principles of Russian life, he said, quote, although not yet shaken, are already weakened. To restore them, it's necessary to extend the famous instruction of January of 1820 for Kazan University to all educational districts of the empire. Now, this should sound familiar to many of you. For years, I've been saying that governments and societies have two choices. They could either pursue the natural law, the common good, which is essentially monarchy, or they could pursue individualism, or what eventually becomes individualism, or oligarchy, and the rule of the sophists. Normally, there's nothing in between. They're very general categories, of course. That Magnitsky formulated these many, many years before me. Another letter to Tsar Nicholas, he said, two teachings are struggling in the world, the first to unite people, and the second to separate them. The one, everything is common, power, faith, duties, and each member of society existing solely for it, contributes to its well-being by the complete submission of his mind, heart, and feelings to the immutable law. The second, on the contrary, everything is then personal, and therefore the place of duties is occupied only by benefits he perceives, power, independence, and that each one, being master of his own mind, heart, and actions, recognizes only one law, his own will, only one rule, his desires, only one bridle, only one force, his passions. Therefore, as soon as external force weakens anywhere, civil strife immediately arises. Everything existing is attacked. Society is subject to destruction. Those are two basic choices that every society has, either stressing the individual or stressing the whole. You stress the whole, you go to, I think it's like military governments or monarchies or, you know, it's really hard to avoid that. You eventually come to that. The liberal democracies can't keep that for long. The U.S. is a very good example of that. And the second is oligarchy. The rule of the wealthy. And they can call things whatever they want. This is the entire purpose of Machiavelli's writing. I've also talked about that here before. So he's working for the Committee for Drafting of the Censorship Statute of 1820-1823. Magnitsky, he drafted the project that banned all works, directly or indirectly, rejected or questioned the teachings of the Holy Scripture and Gospel Revelation. Any work that contained the spirit of sectarianism, or that mixed the pure teachings of the Gospels with ancient false teachings, or with so-called natural magic, Kabbalah, Freemasonry, was also banned. It was also forbidden to publish works which man's will attempts to explain and prove by philosophy, we know as, you know, naturalism, the holy mysteries of the faith which are accessible to it, inaccessible to it. Finally, those works that are weakened, that weaken or undermine the authority of the existing government or monarchy in general, they're subject to a more conditional ban. This is the source of later on the Nicholas's censorship statutes. But for better or for worse, it was very fragmentary in terms of enforcement. Scholars always had access to this kind of thing, but it wasn't widely available otherwise. When I was in college in the early 90s, the regime, liberals would go on and on about censorship, how evil it was. They were all absolutists in that regard. Now that they have completely dominated, and they dominated then, but even more so now, censorship is the order of the day, even prison sentences. Again, censorship is going to exist one way or the other. It depends on whose agenda is going to serve. There is no third way. He also wrote on his third fragment of the Philosophical Mosaic, the special character of the European spirit of the times, much later. But he justifies his actions in the censorship committee by speaking of what revolutionary society really is. All bonds are broken. Man in the middle of society is solitary, has become wild. Public faith has disappeared. Minds left to themselves do not know where to go. They're swayed by the wind of a thousand opposite directions. From this has arisen general disorder, a kind of terrible inconstancy in the way of thinking and institutions. People, as if they're equally tired of both errors and truth, have equally rejected both. Some incredible melancholy, boredom, disgust with life, insatiable need for destruction, have settled in their hearts. This feeling, the insatiable need for destruction, the distinctive character of our times, is revealed in a thousand images in classes, rich and poor, people, nobles, all seem to be pursued and consumed by that same ghost of that century, that revolution, which they've rejected, flee from and hasten to throw themselves into an unknown future. In the present, something in the past still gleams. This flickering reflection frightens them. The frightened mind has stepped over all strongholds, overthrown all barriers. It sees nothing more than general upheaval, general destruction, without even caring to replace it with anything. It wants a new religion, doesn't know what kind. New formation of societies, but not knowing what kind. New legislation and new morals, not knowing what. And in this chaos of riot and senselessness, common sense in society is drowned. Again, I apologize for my poor translation. But now, what he said there was a very early statement of existentialism. The whole concept of the sophists that Plato fought, but they exist everywhere, of course, is that they fought for whoever paid them the most. You know, if I didn't care, I could make any argument sound good. I could cherry pick things. I could find, I could make any argument sound irrefutable. The sophists would, you know, there were lawyers, there were public speakers, there were PR people. They were connected to the wealthy in ancient Athens. And of course, now they rule society to a great extent. But Plato warned us many, many millennia ago. The 1820s, 1830s, he warned us of this situation of postmodern man, without certainty, without knowledge. This may be one of the first expressions of existentialism here, which I don't think anyone has mentioned before. But this is what revolutionary society does. Why do you think I supported the Taliban in Afghanistan? Because their society was exactly like this. All bonds were broken. They had nothing left. Solitary. Public faith had disappeared. Minds left to themselves. I could go on. Warfare for decades. They needed a very strong, native, firm, and violent hand to make something out of that mess. Either that or the American, you know, capitalists would do it. They could do it very well. It's the same concept. Warfare does that to a society. Revolution does that to a society. But it also makes them very, the so-called masses, very suggestible. When Prince Golitsyn was head of the Ministry of Spiritual Affairs and Public Education, the very fact that spiritual affairs and public education were one office was an outrage. But it just led to representatives of just non-Orthodox confessions, every kind of sectarian you could think of, Freemasons, to attack Orthodoxy. It was the ecumenical period of Alexander. But of course, that also created a reaction. The emergence of an Orthodox party that opposed what was called at the time the mystical party. I don't know, mystic, what that means. That was implementing the ideas of a superchurch, of a universal Christianity. That is, of course, no Christianity at all. Golitsyn was considered the head of the mystical side. If you remember that lecture I dealt with in great detail. 1823, Magnitsky joined the Zealots of Orthodoxy. At the time, it was led by Arkady Arakcheyev, Metropolitan Seraphim, Legolevsky of Novgorod and St. Petersburg, and Archimandrite Fotios Spassky. Spassky, very much like Magnitsky, saw all of this coming at a very, very early period. And they set the goal of, you know, changing confessional policy in favor of Orthodoxy. Well, it's an Orthodox country. It almost doesn't have to be said. And eventually, thank God, 1824, Golitsyn was dismissed. And one of these zealots, Alexander Shishkov, who was a Navy man, a brilliant naval record, appointed the new Minister of Public Education. You notice not with, it doesn't have the spiritual side to it anymore. Well, Golitsyn was rightly called one of the culprits of the decline of morality, the right of free thinking, the anti-Orthodox pseudo-mysticism of Russia. Shishkov says, it seems that if all schools have turned into schools of debauchery, and whoever comes out of them will immediately show that he has been seduced from the true path. His head is filled with emptiness and his heart with vanity, the first enemy of prudence. Which we take that for granted today. It's a very delicate situation. The politics of the far right, the right wing, the royalist, orthodox, you know, in Russian society, in the first half of the 19th century, it was precarious because of people like Golitsyn, because of people who were very difficult, like Alexander I, who you never knew what he was going to do from day to day. Because, I think I mentioned this at one point, Magnitsky had been a Mason at one point, therefore they worried about the sincerity of his conversion. Of course, the liberals hated him. So they just said, well, he's just a careerist. Betraying Golitsyn. You know, they just, guess whatever it was, he couldn't satisfy anyone at the time. But of course, today, we can fix that. In the Ministry of Public Education, intrigue began against Magnitsky. The intrigue was initiated by, of all people, Speransky, who, given everything that Magnitsky had done, had come to hate him. His former pupil called on influential officials in the ministry to unite in their fight against him. Shishkov reprimanded Magnitsky for living in Petersburg, given, you know, he was the auditor of Kazan, he should be there. In August of 1825, he forced him out, leave for Kazan for a long period of time. Then, Alexander I either died or became a monk. We're not 100% sure. Let's just say he died. Magnitsky's fate changed dramatically. Early 1926, Nicholas I, who didn't like what he called the obscurantist officials of Alexander's era, ordered yet another audit of Kazan University, which began in 1826 and lasted a month. Magnitsky had embezzled some funds, sort of. Turns out it was only 438 rubles that he used. He was initially accused of 90,000. But eventually the court came to 438 and 15 kopecks was for legitimate reasons. And the court concluded that he was a non-self-seeker or a petty abuser. He was vindicated. One way or another, though, Nicholas I dismissed Magnitsky along with Arakchev and Rurnik. Even his property was sequestered and was exiled to Revel or Tallinn, Estonia. Not much is known about his time living in Estonia for about 6 years. We do know that he collaborated from 1832 on with the monthly journal Raduga, which means rainbow, which was a very orthodox nationalist publication preaching to the Baltics, Baltic region, combating Western ideological influences. Some of what I've quoted here comes from those pieces that he wrote there. For example, all naturalistic teachings, being negative, or what is the same thing, destructive, have as their common origin the dominion of man. And as soon as man recognizes himself as a self-ruler, he is already in revolt against God and against all authority established by him. He ends up being the person that I've mentioned before, the existential dread. Concerning revolutionary doctrine in general, he wrote this. Under the name of science, it adores human reason. For it, science is the god of the world. It believes in it alone. It hopes in it alone. It loves it alone. According to its dogmas, the wisdom and omnipotence of this god must renew the face of the earth and quickly raise man to such a degree of perfection and happiness that he cannot even imagine. This religion has its own complete system, its dogmas, its sacraments, prophecies, even miracles. It has its own worship, its own priesthood, its own missionaries. It is this they want to establish on the ruins of all other religions. And we know he's absolutely correct. All of these sort of organizations end up acting like churches. Atheists are no different. So in early 1831, Magnitsky submitted a series of notes to Nicholas I under the general title Denunciation of the Worldwide Conspiracy Against Altars and Thrones by Public Events and Legal Acts. I've been quoting from it throughout. Set out in detail a certain plan for the Illuminati Masons to seize power in European states and establish world domination. It's significant that in all of these notes, Magnitsky does mention Speransky as part of this conspiracy. Magnitsky was a Freemason. He was someone you could say is a part of the he was illuminated. He was enlightened. Everything was by deception, of course. Magnitsky said to the emperor, and Speransky's still alive, he depicted him as a victim of the Illuminati. They seek to seduce people. Not just any people, important people in the government, various deceptions, to control them for the sake of the broader society. Interestingly, the Jews are mentioned for the first time. Now, I don't know if this is precisely true, because you had the Judaizer controversy a few centuries earlier. But since the Polish partitions, this may have been well, of course, Dzerzhavin's commission, but it's a separate story. One of the first general mainstream condemnations of the Jews and their role in politics. You know, Masonry just is Judaism for the Gentiles. And the Jews, in fact, will use the Illuminati to achieve its secret goals. The world conspiracy is centered in London. The Jews, a few decades after the Polish partition, were now coming into their own as revolutionaries. These weren't theories, these were absolute facts. They were. Here's what Magnitsky said. It was always dangerous, but when Kant placed the praetorship in what he called pure reason, which asked the truth of God, what is true? And the science of the Enlightenment became a speculative and complete system of everything that we saw in the French Revolution in reality. The most dangerous substitution for the gospel revelation. It doesn't refute it. It just passes by in silence, beginning with the assumption that it never existed. It snatches from the hand of God the initial link of the golden chain of legislation and throws it into the chaos of false wisdom. And finally, having refuted the altar of Christ, it inflicts sacrilegious blows in the throne of kings, authorities, the sacrament of marriage. It saw us at the foundation of these three pillars, which the vault of the public building rests. This danger, the science of natural law, was demonstrated recently. I don't know specifically what he meant by that, but something had happened. Now, at the time, the Jews still had their Kahal system, but that wasn't going to last much longer. It was already on its last legs. After that, Magnitsky became close to governor of Mikhail Vorontsov of Odessa. In fact, he even dedicated one of his works, A Brief Guide to Business and State Literature for Officials Entering the Service, published in Moscow in 1835, in gratitude for the transfer that he allowed to the South. They developed a very good relationship. And in fact, it was Vorontsov that introduced him to Alexandru Sturdza and his sister, Roxandra Idling. Alexandru Sturdza was a Romanian-Russian. Somehow, though, because of the asceticism that Magnitsky always lived under, in exile in Odessa, he reconciled with even Golitsyn. On the advice of Archimandrite Gabriel Rozanov, later the Archbishop of Kherson, Magnitsky asked forgiveness of 1837, even from Speransky, when he was there in Odessa. Sturdza introduced Magnitsky into a circle that included prominent Odessa officials, including the Odessa urban mayor, Count Tolstoy, who unfortunately was intriguing against Vorontsov, the governor. Remember how we talked about last week what this guy really did? Magnitsky would go, he was an auditor, he audits, he exposes corruption, he exposes waste and fraud. He can't help himself. He does it even when he's not asked to do it. Well, he did it here without being asked. He compiled an annual report on the mayor's office. Vorontsov, in fact, was reprimanded for all bureaucratic blunders made in Odessa, police disorders and other things. It even reached the Council of Ministers. In 1839, he was exiled even from his place of exile. It was too difficult. And to some extent, he was. It's not that what he exposed was false, but he couldn't help himself. Magnitsky was an auditor. Wherever he was sent, if you remember from last week, wherever he was sent, he would compile a report on how money was being spent, how bureaucrats were being worked, hiring policy, firing policy, this kind of thing, normal stuff, position of the nobility, position of the peasantry, students, you know, if it's a university. He can't help it. It was almost a reaction in him. He couldn't help himself. So he moved to Kherson under police supervision. But Magnitsky was getting sick, coming to the end of his life. And so Vorontsov asked again for him to return to Odessa. In his retirement, he studied Greek. He translated books by the ancient writers and wrote articles for Mikhail Pogodin. I can't think of it right now. The name of the journal. Moskvianin, that's it. Which was a stellar early right-wing publication. Unfortunately, he was big into the Normanist theory. It's on separate issue. Okay. We can't get into that, but his favorite books were the Gospels and the works of the Dmitri of Rostov. He hadn't been canonized yet, I don't think. But he audited himself like he audited everything else, which meant he was a confessor's dream. He always held up the peasants as the dominant example. That's the kind of faith that we need. It wasn't an ignorant faith, not by any means. It just wasn't necessarily discursive. He's one of the few men who was able to reconcile with everybody. By the time he died, November 21st, 1844, he died of pneumonia, buried in Odessa. In the 30s, it was overdone. You know, there's a park named after Lenin that was established there. I don't know if they, you know, they even made recognition of the bodies there or not, but they certainly had no love for him. So I want to conclude our talk about this great man. This great, very eccentric man. He had a very bright personality. He started off as a cosmopolitan liberal and Mason. And he saw what that really meant in practice, especially when he was when he became ambassador in France. Then he became, slowly but surely, anti-Mason and became a part of that trend in Russian conservatism based on orthodoxy. Russia should follow its own path for development. That's not a trend. That's what Russian conservatism is. We've tried to, I've tried to, you know, connect the evolution from this Western Orient, he was even a deist for a while, to a member of the Zealot of Orthodoxy. It made him plenty of enemies along the way, including people who didn't think it was all that sincere, because he had been a student of Speransky. He was one of the first to mention the Jewish issue after the partitions. Uvadov's Orthodox Autocracy Nationality, without the nationality part, was first mentioned by Magnitsky. Uvadov, who took over, was a good thing he took over, simply expanded on it. He was not servile, because wherever he was, he had to audit. And he didn't care who he, almost like he had a certain kind of autism. Even for some of his allies, he irritated, but it doesn't matter. Big thing to take from him, that this is one of the men, one of the very few men who saw the revolution coming in the 1820s, if not before. He saw how they were developing in Russia. They tried to shut him up. Even though he had been a Mason, even though he had been a student of Speransky, as soon as he became ambassador to, or a secretary to the ambassador in Paris, everything changed. Let alone, of course, the invasion of Napoleon. Revolution was a threat, and the Decembrists were a part of it. I don't want anyone to overlook that. As far as Russian history goes, a lot of spoiled kids from all the elite military academies tried to take over, using this poor Constantine for their own purposes. They didn't care. It's just like, you know, the conditions that they were going to give to, the oligarchs going to give to, Anna, we mentioned a few weeks ago. The Empress Anna, so-called. Constitutional monarchy, in any sense of the word that I can make sense out of, means that other people are controlling the agenda and are hiding behind them. Otherwise, you have monarchy. You don't have that Tea Party joke in like, for example, in Britain. This man was an extraordinary intellect and visionary, and he saw education and the universities as key everything we know today to be true. He was talking about in the 1820s. Who listened to him? And today, he remains very obscure, unrighteously. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.